All right, this is the new American Dream Radio Show. I am Chuck Gregory, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I'm glad that you could join us tonight. I think we're going to have a really good show. We're focusing tonight on prisons. And as I always do, I'm going to open the show with a song, and then I will be introducing my guests. So here we go. I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling round the bend. I ain't seen the sunshine since, I don't know when. I'm stuck at Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antonio. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. I bet there's rich folks eating in a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee, smoking big cigars. But I know it had it coming. I know I can't be free. Those people keep on moving, and that's what tortures me. If they freed me from this prison, if that railroad train was mine, I bet I'd move it on a little farther down the line. Far from Folsom Prison, that's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away. All right. We have a really good show tonight. We're focusing on prisons and prison issues. And my guest tonight are the Reverend Canon Patero Sabuni. He's an Africa Partnership Officer for the Episcopal Church, and he previously was the pastor and Protestant chaplain at Sing Sing. And he has quite a story for us. Frank Cordero, who will be joining us just in a recording, runs the Des Moines Catholic Worker. Anthony Rayson is an American anarchist, activist, and author. He runs the South Chicago ABC Zine Distro. Michael Annis is a publisher, writer, poet, artist, and musician. He runs Howling Dog Press. He's been called the most dangerous poet on the planet. And Azura Crispino is the founder of Prison Abolition Prisoner Support, which believes that the prison industrial complex in all its forms must be abolished. So these are going to be some really good guests. The way this is going to work, we're going to let one guest be the focus for each of our segments, and we're going to kick off the show with Patero Sabuni. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Patero, and please tell us some more about yourself and what you have to say.
Thank you, Chuck, and I'm happy to be with you, colleagues and friends. As Chuck mentioned, I was at Sing Sing from 2004, and I retired from there. While there, I worked with guys who were in education. I helped for the last 2 years before retiring. I was the director of the master's program. Some people don't know that there's a very powerful education program at Sing Sing Prison in Ossining, New York. Both Bard College, Mercer College, have programs there. People can get the associate degree and bachelor's degree. So I directed the master's program for 2 years at Sing Sing Prison. As you well know, Sing Sing is a maximum security prison upstate New York in Austin. And as I said before, I started in 2004. Perhaps the most revealing part of the father and his grandfather now was realizing that these are men at Sing Sing could be my own kids, could be my son, could be my brother, could be my cousin. And so when men get arrested and arraigned and indicted and tried and convicted and sentenced before they come upstate, they become GC, which is general confinement. That's what they called in A block, one of the biggest blocks of 600 men live in A block. I used to say to them, what if GC was not general confinement, but God's child? Because you are God's child, just like my son, like me. So my time at Sing Sing, during the time I was there, showed me that I too, by the grace of God, go I. So one of the things that was really revealing to me was the sense of the humanity or denial thereof, that the men there were just human beings who had made a mistake, who among us can be known for the worst thing we ever did. So I spent my time there trying to remind them that they are too GC, God's child, just like me and just like my children. So one of the most perhaps memorable moments for me were working with the other chaplains. We have Muslim, Jewish, Catholic, Buddhist, and other denominations. So I found it very revealing to spend time with those men, working with the men in our different traditions. Half the men obviously are not religious, the half are. We had to work with everybody. It didn't matter what religion they were. We had no religion at all. They were only human beings, children of God, as I said before. And one of the issues that that impacted me was the sense of awe and wonder that in a place like Sing Sing, in maximum security prison, there are glimmers of hope. As I'm sure some of you have read Brian Stevenson's book, Just Mercy. But one of the things he says, and I used that book with the men while I was there, that there are four things we need to be in touch with: places like Sing Sing, like Angola, like Attica, like other places that house imprisoned God's children. Because when we do that, we're able to tell a credible story. That's one last thing he said. Once we get in touch with those places, we need to go to those places. As you know, he spent his career defending men on death row and juveniles serving life without parole. He says we have to be in touch with those places. Secondly, if we're in touch with those places, we're able to tell a credible story, to change the narrative, because most people who tell those stories, it's a myth. They make it up. These are dangerous men. These are killers. They're dangerous. So he says we have to be in those places, tell the narrative, and change it, and tell the narrative of the truth of what's happening. The third thing he says, Brian Stevenson, is when we do that, it gives us hope. It gives us hope. Change the narrative, tell the story, get hope. And last thing he says, which was perhaps for me most revealing was that if we do that, then we get in touch with our own brokenness, because we're all wounded or broken, as Henry Nouwen, one of the great theologians of our time, Henry Nouwen, the wounded healer, says that we're all broken. So tell the story, credibility, sense of hope, and lastly, get in touch with our own brokenness. And I found a sense of forgiveness and hope and even joy in places like Sing Sing. So I'm happy to be with you on this show. I look forward to many other times of speaking with you. And again, it's a joy and an honor, and it's humbling to be with you. Thank you. And now I look forward to listening to the rest of the show tonight.
Well, okay. Well, I have a question for you.
Sure.
You talked about being, I don't remember your exact term, but being part of it, being present with these people. Can we really do that? Can we be part of that experience from the outside?
No, we, yes and no. When you're a chaplain, at least in New York, I don't know about other states, Chuck, but when you're a chaplain, you're there 40 hours a week, and you have access to every place in the prison. Now, you need to determine where to go. So you get to go to places inside, in the cells, in A block, B block, five building. So you're not just there for worship and religious services. You're really there for anyone. As I said to you, I was I head of the master's program.
Yeah.
For the men, we graduated, over 500 men have graduated from master's program at Sing Sing, and Bard College and Mercy College have degree programs. So can you get into, no, you can never be in a near place. No, you can't. But at the same time, you're able to meet their families, their children. One of the things we did before I left was to let children visit with their fathers, which is almost unheard of, to be able to be with their fathers by themselves. And we had to fight very hard to get that approved. As you know, governments, bureaucracies are almost impossible. But we had to get a grant proposal and write it. We got the support of people like Coach Dungy. Coach Dungy, Tony Dungy, came up to Sing Sing to help us install that program so that children could come and spend 3 hours with their fathers. So, yes, it's not, you can't be in their shoes, obviously. But as a chaplain, you have the right to go to any place. Now, some officers will tell you you can't do that, so you have to push, and you have to, you know, to be determined, courageous, and be able to go to places that. So, is that answer your question? Is that what you're asking, or did I answer?
Yes, that's very much what I was asking, and it strikes me that you, as chaplain, were able to go not only places that we, the general public, would not have access to, but also many places that the prisoners do not have access to.
Yes. you can go to places because the prisoners inside Sing Sing, when I started out in 2004, January 8th, They're not allowed to go to each other's place. They can go to the yard. There's A block yard, B block yard, five building, and so on. But there's an honor block where they can apply to be admitted to, which is an honor block, which most of the students who are in the Bard College program, which is the Bard Prison Initiative and Mercer College. But you can go, I suppose, in New York. I don't know about other states, but in New York, you have to find out your rights. You have to remind officers and the men and the captains and lieutenants that you have the right to go there. So if you go and the officer says you can't go there, you say, no, I have the right to be here. I need to visit. I need to be with those men who are in that place, in that yard. So it's really your own initiative, partly. Partly it's how far you will be able to go, how far you can push, because the law says you have the right to be there. Judges, clergy, I believe legislators, according to New York law, I have to, maybe next time we talk, I'll find out the law. There's a law that allows you to be there. But most people don't know that. But New York, you do have the right to go to any place in the prison once you're a chaplain. So you have to find out what the law is.
Okay. Well, we have also with us already Anthony Brayson and Azura Crispino. And so I would like to see if they have some questions for you. So just so that we don't all step on each other, let me just kind of, you know, we can take turns. So, Anthony, do you have any questions for Patero?
Well, Chaplain, are there other religions that have chaplains at that prison you were working in, Sing Sing? Like, do the Muslims have an imam? And what all?
Yes, Imam Mumin. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I know that there are full-time chaplains there and then part-time chaplains. So Rabbi Epstein, Imam Mumin, Father Ron, myself, were the four that were full-time because of the population in New York. Okay. And then they're part-time. So you have the Buddhist chaplain, Greek Orthodox. You have some like volunteer chaplains also. So if they come,
some of the,
is that what you're asking?
The lesser religions or belief systems, they have real trouble getting their ceremonies, such as the Native Americans have a very difficult time getting their ceremonies.
Yeah, we have.
Lodges.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. And maybe again, some of the questions I'll have to look it up because I know that we have a Native chaplain, Native American chaplain for not just for Sing Sing, but who goes around the state, hired by the state. So I have to find out and give you more specific when we talk next time. I have to remember that. I'm making a note for myself because I remember he would come to Sing Sing once a month, and there was a difficulty in establishing practices. Like, are you allowed to practice your religion, like the Santeria, Voodoo, because there were not that many? So it's according to population, but I have to find out more information about that. But we did work together very well with the Native American chaplain because they would come to Sing Sing once a month. But the Imam and Rabbi Epstein and Father Ron and myself, but we had, and we had over 90 different religions at Sing Sing when I was there.
Okay, how about, now some folks aren't that interested in religion, they're more politically oriented. What about those political groups, those activist prisoner groups, how are they treated?
Say that again, I'm sorry, could you repeat that question, please?
You know, some of the prisoners get together and they form like study groups to study politics. And, you know, they develop a political ideology and they want to share that. How are they allowed to do that? What goes on there?
Well, it depends because, again, if you're forming a group, let's take an example one group is called the Exodus Group. So they have a study group that meets on Friday night in Greenhaven. I happen to know that because I was part of that when I was in seminary. And so the chaplain at Greenhaven would meet Friday night for a study group. Reverend Muller, Ed Muller was the chaplain at Greenhaven. This is before I came thinking. I'm talking about another prison, another maximum security prison that I know about. So we borrowed that because once you're established in a prison, once you're established, then you have precedent. So you can refer to it. You can say, I want to establish a study group because another prison has one. So this way you can make a reference to it so they allow you to have it. So we had anything from JCs to NACP, We had Unidos, Latino Unidos group meeting. So we have several, there were several groups, but you have to, initially to start out is very difficult. But once you get established, because when I started out in 2004, there were 71 prisons in New York. And out of that, maybe a third a maximum, there's a medium, there's a minimum. Again, depends on what, you know, what status you are. Maximum security prisons like Sing Sing are much harder to establish programs. But if you're under program, a department called program education, so if you're establishing a legitimate education program and you want to study the works of Brian Stevenson or Paulo Freire or anyone, then you have to establish that this is a legitimate scholar, because some people don't know, so some they reject it. But again, as I said, Reverend Muller over at Greenhead, once he started that, this was, I was in seminary in 1978 when I started to attend that, when I was a seminarian. So when I came to Sing Sing as a chaplain in 2004, it was still going on because it was ready to be precedent. So once you find out you can do it, and again, in New York, the aftermath of Attica was very instructive in trying to establish programs. This was 1973. So by the time I came as a seminarian, a student, I was able to understand what was going on.
When was that, 73, you say?
Yes, sir. September 73 was...
Okay, that was in the wake of the Attica Rebellion then.
Yeah, yes, sir.
There was,
yes, sir.
Reforms
that was.
That were unleashed,
yes,
a little bit, loosened.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, but, you said something interesting, whether the group is, quote, legitimate. Now, that is subject to interpretation by,
yes,
of course, the prison authorities. I mean, if
that's
they don't
right.
like what you're saying, you're not legitimate, no matter what you're trying to say.
That's right.
You know? So
absolutely.
A lot of people don't want to go along with the program, but they want to study. And that's where a guy like me comes in. I work directly with these writers and artists to publish their work so we can educate other prisoners, you know, and everybody in general. But a lot of times that they don't support the prison program, or, you know, they're against the prison, the prisoners. They don't want to be slaves, the captives, you know. They're against the prison
system.
Right. So am I. So they have a hellacious time once their activities are discovered. And it's really horrible what happens. You know, some of these people, it's just endless torture for them just to express their First Amendment rights.
Okay.
You know,
I'm,
they may not like what they have to say.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but
sure.
It's time for our station break almost. And Azura, I'm sorry that you didn't get to get a word in, but you're going to get the first set of questions in the next segment. Thank you, Patero and Anthony. Very interesting segment, and I look forward to talking to you some more after the station break in about 4 minutes. So, and thank you, listeners, for joining us. All right, everyone, welcome back to the New American Dream Radio Show, streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Azura, you didn't get a chance to ask Patero a question that you told me about, and I'd like to give you that opportunity now.
Yes. Thank you for that. So you had mentioned that you really have to push in order to get these programs. And I was wondering if you could go into a little bit more detail as to how you pushed. And the motivation for this question is that as a chaplain, you are working for the prison, but you're also working for the prisoners or on behalf of the prisoners. And obviously that means that you have to walk a tightrope between advocating for them, but not angering the people that would be able to grant you that. So I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit to that tension.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. As I said before, When I was in seminary in 1978 at Union Theological Seminary, I had the opportunity to do field work in a prison, Greenhaven Prison. And I met a chaplain by the name of Ed Muller. And he had the study group Friday night. So I had also, I sort of had an introduction to that, how he did that. This was after Attica, as I said, was a couple of years after Attica. So, and he did that. So when I became a chaplain, I sort of had a mentor, if you want to call him a mentor. So at Sing Sing, I started to ask questions about how, because I had known of his reputation, his record, that you have to, as you said, you have to walk a tight rope. But at the same time, you have to remember who you are and whose you are, that you can't compromise. There are some things that are non-negotiable. Because when you're a maximum security prison, officers will tell you, you can't do that, you can't do that. You got to be able to stand your ground and say, what do you mean you can't do that? According to the law of the state of New York, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So you have to be able, first of all, there's something called directives of New York State. They run the department by directives. You have to be able to read all the directives and know what you're talking about. You can't just come in and say, well, I'm a chaplain, I work for God, therefore. No, you can't do that. You have to be able to do those programs and know what you're talking about, because otherwise it will get you in big, big mess. And also you have to be careful. I hope I'm not speaking out of school, but some of my colleagues are going to be in trouble for stepping outside the established rules that if you come in, let's say you work from this time to this time, and the men, as you know, in a maximum security prison, there's something called the count. So you have to be counted. And you have to go back to your block to be counted. As a chaplain, I have the right to request that they remain with me so they can study, do homework, and so on. But you have to list them on the out count. You have to submit that to the lieutenant. Lieutenant submit the sergeant. You have to be very, very meticulous how you do that. Because any slip-up could cause them and you to get in trouble. So you have to study the law. You have to study directives. You have to have a good mentor that you're not going to be stepping, you know, I can do this because I'm chaplain. No, you can't. You know, this is the department. So you're working for the men. And so some of the officers obviously will say, well, he's here for the men. He's not here for us. But eventually, even the humanity comes through. I'll give you an example. One of the men who had gone to the parole board 4 times, had been hit every time. So we begged him to go back the 5th time. He wouldn't go. He said, I'm not going. They've hit me before. I'm not going. And he was a graduate of our program. One of the officers in his block said, you know, come on. What do you have to lose? You know, Rev said go. Imam said go. Rabbi said go. Come on. Guess what? He went and got. He got paroled. So there are those glimpses of hope that are not many but do exist. You have to hold on to them. You have to hold on to the flickering candle in the darkness. So you have to be able to remember those moments when they introduce you to their families, when they come to the visiting room. You have to make sure you go to the visiting room so you can meet their mom and their dad and their brother and their sister. So you get a full picture that they're not just prisoners, but they are human beings with real lives who before they didn't just get born. Nobody gets born to be a prisoner. This is a place where you are with them. Is that making sense? Am I answering your question, or you want to be more specific and ask more specific questions? Is that making sense to you?
You are making sense, but what I struggle with, let me put it this way, is that
yes.
I have a very difficult time being nice to these people. You know, especially when, you know, you mentioned visiting rooms. There was a chaplain when I was visiting my husband this last time around, and I was trying to get him to intervene because he's a Kairos graduate, but he's not on the list. And I really struggled to get the minister to do his job. And there's a part of me that, on one hand, I really want to advocate strongly on behalf of prisoners, but sometimes I hesitate to call prison officials because I'm afraid I'm going to lose my temper and I'm going to cuss them out. And there's something to be said for the people that I'm advocating on their behalf. It's not usually strategic. I mean, every once in a while, you have prisoners that want you, you know, to do that sort of thing. Hi, Sean.
Right, if you're listening.
I'm thinking of you. But leaving that aside, usually it's the case that you need to be diplomatic, but you need to be firm. And so I was
wondering
if you could speak or tell a story to how you handled that tension, because it's something that I've struggled with in the last 8 years, and I don't feel like I have an answer to that personally.
Right. I'm not sure I have an answer to that either, but I'll try. During my time, I cannot tell you how many times I came up against that very thing you're talking about, in which I've been in a visiting room, sitting with a man and his family, an officer would look at me and say, you know, come over here. And I said, why? He said, what are you doing? I said, I'm doing my job. So why are you here? He said, because I'm supposed to be here. He said, no, you're not. I said, yes, I am. So that happened all the time. So you have to stand your grounds. You have to know the law. You don't know what you're talking about. And you have to know where you're standing. You're not just standing some flimsy because I'm supposed to be. You have to say, you know, according to the rules and directives. Now, I have to say on behalf of my colleague chaplains, there's some of the chaplains, as you say, who don't do their work. And I've known many, many who just say, well, you know, I'll be part of the program, or I'll be part of the system. No, you're there called to serve the men. That's why you're there. So whether it's a man who are coming and asking you to do their wedding or to do their family, we have something called FRP New York, Family Reunion Program, in which families, you know, spouses, children, parents can come and stay there for 3 days. And that's one of the most difficult things to get approved because, again, an officer will say you can't go down there. So you have to be an advocate. You have to be almost, you have to call up. And I know, at least in maximum security prison like Sing Sing, the person in charge is the watch commander. So when families say, look, I came down here, I'm supposed to get my family reunion program, I'm outside, they won't let me in, what I'll say to them is call the watch commander and make sure you put that on record. Ask for the name, as you're talking to, make sure you record it and have a temperate voice. Don't yell, don't scream. And you can tell them that the chaplain told you that. And you can tell them my name. And then the watch commander will call me and say, Rev, did you tell? I said, yes, sir, I did. I spoke to the mom or to the sister or to the wife or to, and the outside, they want to come in. So those little, what you call them, again, I call them glimpses of hope. They're not many, but they're there. Those flickering lights in the darkness, whether it's a visiting room or family reunion program or someone trying to get in the college program, those little hints of hope that exist. So that's what I tried to do when I was there during my time. And again, I had a mentor who was very, very strong, who knew the law, who, again, I saw how he did it, that he had the oil temperament, you know. So I want to talk to the officer. I go to the sergeant. I talk to the lieutenant. I go to watch commander. And you can actually call the superintendent. And I tell the parent, I said, you know, you can call Sing Sing. I give him the number. When the operator comes, say, you want to talk the superintendent. And they'll connect you. They have to connect you. If the worst comes to worst, you can call. You can call the commissioner. So those are little. Is that making sense? Did I answer your question?
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. All right. We at this point, I want to play the conversation I had earlier today with Frank Cordero of the Des Moines Catholic Worker, and I think it will explain itself. So here we go.
I know.
Hello, Chuck.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
Hi. So I'm a shower head, and that means you're in charge of, you know, the kitchen and the people who are taking showers, and
okay.
I'm leaving to do this interview, and the one of our most difficult guests has 2 minutes to get out of the shower. So and then I says, I got to go. I told him, I prepped him. I says, got to go. That's the interview. And they're going like, you're leaving when you're blue. You're leaving. That's what blue. So that's the drama going on here.
Well, you need to wait another 10 minutes?
No, we could do it. Let's do it.
Okay.
Yeah. Now's the time. And then the other. Okay. Yeah. The other thing I'm. Are you there?
Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing immediately here is Trump is coming to Des Moines. He's doing one of his rallies here.
And, oh, you know, how wonderful.
You're duty bound to show up and go protest. So that's why I asked you to call me sooner, because I'm just going to show up on the campus where this is happening and join the other people yelling and screaming just to can't let a monster like that get in town, especially on the night before he's going to be found innocent for lack of evidence. Really crazy, isn't it? And all that's happening. And I've been trying to ruminate about the topic of your night, jails and prisons.
Okay.
And I'm reminded that in August of 2014, I had the privilege to give a kind of a workshop to a group of federal judges in Omaha at one of their regional annual, you know, gatherings. And a couple of judges, one of them in Des Moines here, knew of my reputation and that I had been in federal prisons five different decades doing these 6-month bits and wanted a perspective from the bottom up. So I couldn't ask for a better audience of around 30, you know, primarily magistrate federal judges and district judges from the central region to speak to. So that was very, very interesting. And the way I started off is I told them that we have something in common, because I was a Catholic priest for 19 years. So I know what it means to be in a compromised system. And what I was going to tell them that day, predicated on the belief that if you don't believe the system's rotten, you're not going to understand a word I have to say. And then I said, the other thing I have back in me, and we have in common, is that there are only two professions. Jesus was very clear that he didn't have any one good thing to say about him. And all you have to do is go to Matthew 23, the scribes and the Pharisees, the priests and the lawyers. So I says, Jesus didn't have much to think of our profession either. And the good priest that I knew, I said, did good work, and they also did not lie about how compromised our church is. And if you guys are going to do good work, you really shouldn't lie about how compromised the federal system is. And the federal justice system, like all of the justice systems, both state and federal in this country, have suffered greatly in the last 40 years. From my recollection, the conditions, the overcrowding, the incredible shift from tax-paid systems to for-profit systems, and the whole thing is predicated on the criminalization of poverty that's taken place. By that I mean, the first thing one needs to know is that there is a justice system, and it's divided in two parts. We have a civil court and criminal court. Listen to this. All of the big money is in civil court. Most of the lawyers in this country are either doing tax, real estate, property tax. All of those things are in the civil courts. The little money is in the criminal court. Now that should begin with. Now in the criminal court, the thing you need to know about all criminal cases in our system is that about 95% of them never go to trial. That means 95. But you gotta include the trespassers. There's the drunks. Because those are all criminal cases, and rarely do people plead guilty. They just plead guilty and plead out. Nobody takes these things to trial.
Right.
Rarely do people go to criminal court and a trial. And even in the big cases like our friend Jess and Ruby are under this federal kind of system where at the first, what they do is they pile on tons of cases, tons of crimes. And then people have to make a deal. Everybody has to make a deal. That's how this whole system's run. And then the bottom end, if you've ever done a night in jail, which I have done on a regular basis through the years, or go down to court, day court, traffic court, it's all about a collection agency. It's all about paying fines.
Hmm.
And they make the poor pay. And the other thing that, the other thing in my county is that if I go to jail, I have to pay a jail fee, $65 a day.
Huh.
A jail fee. So
wow.
It's a really cockeyed system at this time. It just like overwhelmingly gives the advantage to people with money. The fix is in from the top to the bottom. And the poor, by that I mean the criminalization of being poor, is that the way in which the poor people interface with our justice system is they're in these petty parking tickets, trespass tickets, domestic violence stuff, just any number of these low-level crimes that put them behind the eight ball. They just don't get out of it. They keep paying. They're on a cycle.
Right.
It's just really insidious. And that's before we're talking about, you know, good treatment or bad treatment inside these places.
Mm-hmm.
And people need to know that the treatment has, you know, part of having a 5-decade perspective is you can see the quality of care or lack of care as you go through these county jails year in and year out. In these federal prisons. And believe me, the quality of care that prison people in jails get stuck with here in this country is just awful. And with little or no recourse to go. So that's been my experience. And I've done a, you know, total of maybe 6 years in jail. Four of those 6 years, I got by doing 8 different 6-month bits for trespass at Offutt.
Uh-huh.
Over a 4-decade, 5-decade time.
Right.
And then the other thing I did a plowshares action in 98 and ended up just doing 6 months for that. So I was given a gift for that. Mm-hmm. So I know something of these places and, it's not good. And they're in much need of reform. The control of these systems ought to be brought back to the governments and states, and not in these private corporations that are making tons of money off the justice system.
Right,
doing it cheaper than the government does, but at what cost? And so much, so much. I can say that for sure. Yeah, yeah. So I'm glad you're covering the issue of prisoners. The only thing I would add is that the problem with the peace movement, so-called peace movement, and now ecology movement in this country is we have yet to create a culture of incarceration for acts of justice and resistance. By that I mean we've got the largest prison system in the world. More people like us should be in jail doing time for good stuff, and at the same time automatically being a witness and walking in solidarity with the 2 million people who are suffering under a really oppressive prison system. So until we start getting real in our social movements, incorporating and making jail an acceptable and common thing that needs to be done, going to jail, when I don't think anybody's going to take all that serious. I just don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Frank.
So jail,
thank
as
you
were speaking of it, yes. Go ahead. It may well be the answer for the movement people to start interfacing with prison, doing these things. That's what I'd say. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Well,
thank you, Chuck. I got to go back to the kitchen. right.
Thank you for being with us, and thank you for your dedication to the causes and being willing to go to jail for us.
Thank you. Thank you, Chet. God bless.
But God bless. Bye-bye. Well, the comments that Frank made at the end there about how we need to go in there and be part of this and go get on the inside and protest that way. I thought that was part of why I asked you the question I did at the beginning, Patero. Patero, are you still there? Are you muted, perhaps? Okay. Anthony or Azura, are you still there? Okay.
Yeah, I'm here.
Well, okay.
So, I actually wanted to make a comment about Anthony, if that's all right, and it's a compliment. So Anthony
Great.
And I both supported the same prisoner at the time that he was incarcerated, Miggs. And Miggs said something about you, Anthony, that I think you should hear, which is he said, for a guy who's never been in, he's the only person who acts like he truly understands.
Wow.
And I think it is possible to be in solidarity and be with prisoners enough that you get a sense. I don't think I'm there yet. I haven't been doing this, you know, as long as Anthony has, for sure. You know, and something else that I got from Miggs was just being able to say, I understand that I don't understand. I don't understand what you're going through, but that nevertheless, I'm going to try to stand beside you. So I have a concern with the fetishization of arrest and going to prison as part of activism. You know, I certainly don't want to be adding to the prison population. I mean, if it happened, then that's fine. I've made my peace with that for myself. But yeah, so that was the only concern that I had with that, is that I wonder if sometimes, especially with, you know, the advent of Orange is the New Black and all of the reality TV shows that are around prison, that it to what extent are we maybe, I don't know if exalting is the right word, but putting the
wrong thing, perhaps.
Yeah. On. Thank you.
Yeah. Very, very good questions. We have like two more minutes in this segment. So this was supposed to be Anthony's segment after a little brief thing from Frank, and we ended up kind of using it up a different way, but we'll work things out. Why don't Anthony, why don't you kind of close us out? We've got 1 minute, telling us a little bit about your zine distro, and really brief.
Well, okay. You know, I work with prison writers and artists, and I publish their work and get back into the prisons mainly, get study circles going, and you know, try to get them education that they need, whether it's legal or and that political analysis or how to deal with their situation psychologically or whatever the thing that interests them. I try to get them something about it, and now we have over 1,200 of these zines available now, and also DePaul sends them to prisoners too, which is really great. They got a great team there that works their ass off sending killer zines to prisoners. And in the next segment, I want to read what prisoners had to say, because if you're going to talk about prisons, you got to hear from the prisoners themselves. So I want to read a couple of pieces that will really underscore what that's been talked about and what this system is all about and how it happens and who suffers because of it. You hear it from the horse's mouth, and it sort of hits you more impactfully,
yeah.
I think. So.
Okay. Well, actually, that's probably going to be part of the final segment, and you're going to be sharing it with Azura, I think. This next one is supposed to be Michael Annis, and we may or may not have a little time to fit in, you know, something into that one. We will find out.
This is about a five minute piece that I want to
Very good,
you guys.
All right. It's time for our station break. I hope you listeners are finding this as interesting as I am. And please stick with us and be back in 4 or 5 minutes after the station break. But, hey, don't forget it. Revolution Radio is listener supported. All right. Well, we are... We're back on the New American Dream Radio Show. I'm Chuck Gregory, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Our prison-focused show is going very well. I am I'm now going to be adding Michael Annis, who is going to join us from Denver, Colorado, and... We'll see what he has to say for us. dialing him right now.
Hello.
Well, hello, Michael. It's the New American Dream Radio Show. You're here with Chuck Gregory, Patero Sabuni, Anthony Rayson, and Azura Crispino.
And Frank Cordero, who was recorded.
Well, yeah, but we already played him, so.
Exactly.
All right.
So I listened to the first hour.
Okay, great.
Once again, thank you for having me back as a guest on the New American Dream. I look forward to it. I think this is a very valuable program of a podcast. So I've been really, as you know, here I wind up, as you know, the last couple of days, I've been under this incredible duress and in kind of a frantic mode. I'm trying to overcome that. Today, I spent some time. I have so much material here that has been very hard for me to select. But I do have something. Which way should I go? You know, I mean, I have go down this street. Okay, it makes.
Uh-huh.
what is going to tie in? Okay, so I want to. I first want to start off by saying that I respect the opinions of all of the people, and who are on your program here, and I have found that probably the person I'm most inclined to say expresses my viewpoints, although I really liked what Frank Cordero had to say. Is Anthony, and a big shout out to Anthony. I really appreciate what he's doing. And I used to, as a publisher at Howling Dog Press, I gathered a lot of information, publications, and so forth. And coming directly from prisoners, I have two right in front of me, and I would like to read the titles on the fronts of these two publications. And I know that Anthony knows these publications. Missouri Prisoners Labor Union. And Anthony is listed, actually, under the contributors, the contents, et cetera, on the inside, as being an outside supporter. So, more power to you, Anthony. And believe me, I'm not being condescending, because your work is far more extensive and greater than mine. Okay. So, cover number one. Headline, at the dawn of industrialism, factories were modeled after prisons. In its twilight, prisons are modeled after factories. Cover number two, and this is a really important one because I want to tie it into, as a former teacher of literature, grammar, etc., poetics, speech, whatever, drama, we must stop thinking that those who profit from keeping us bound will ever do anything to set us free. That's very important. I warned my students probably in 1997 because many of my students had just gotten out of the joint. Some of them were destined to go to the joint if they didn't figure out a way and the means to turn out, turn their lives around, so they could, in quote, be productive in society according to how society defines productivity. And believe me, that's an entirely a discussion into and of itself. But I warned them, after reading articles about it, that, look, what they're doing here is they're figuring out a way to make the prison system highly profitable. And when they do that, if you go in, you will stay in. And the reason for that is because you don't have to be paid anything above slave wages, and they're going to keep you there. So given that, several of my students were a genius level. I had one young man that was bona fide, tested out 180 IQ, and many of them were over 150 IQ. I had one who I dearly loved. I loved them all, but I have one who was from Korea. And she had grown up in a Korean orphanage and then had been adopted by a pastor, and her and her brother brought back to the United States. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Wanted to be a writer, and took me, asked me to take her on as a student, personal student, and she wanted me to mentor her, which I did. Well, she was so brilliant that she ended up doing 4 years by getting herself in trouble. She ended up doing 4 years at the Colorado Women's down in Pueblo, of which she informed me that approximately 80% of the prisoners down there were Native Americans. So that is a big issue. It's a big issue for me. Just to clarify, so I don't approach the subject of incarceration religiously or via religion, nor as an atheist. I've always approached the subject through direct contact with prisoners via letter or whatever, through poetry and art. And I have a deep personal experiential understanding of what prison means. The prison of sickness, being a prisoner in your own body and unable to ever break free, unable to ever be paroled from that, seeing the daily suffering that goes on and on and on without hope of turning it around. Well, when the writer I was speaking of originally, Sun Young Lee, she wrote me almost every day, and she would write these long letters. I wanted to bring literature into her prison situation. I offered through Howling Dog Press multiple copies of everything that I had published without payment. Just, I will send it, I'll pick up the cost of shipping, I will pick up the cost of everything. I just would like to see it in your library, and it's been requested by one of your inmates. So I don't run out of time, so I leave time for, and once again, augmenting what Anthony had to say, allowing a prisoner to speak for herself. I want you to listen to a poem that Sun Young Lee wrote to me as a prisoner in Colorado's women's prison down in Pueblo, okay? It is titled Shrivel Portfolio. Her black eyes stare into the darkness, her pupils piercing through the darkness by the reflection of the dull fluorescent lights shining through the thin rectangle panes of the cell door windows. Her hip bones peek out from the waist of her pants. Her legs have lost some of their muscle tone. She eats. The portions of her tray are small, but she never feels hungry anymore. She closes her eyes, but she is not sleeping. Why does she feel so lonely at night? She does not spend her time with the women of the module during the day. She leaves her cell only occasionally. As darkness falls, her sadness falls. She is slipping into depression. She scrambles and reaches to stop herself, but she is at bay. Is it about learning how to avoid depression, or is it about learning how to survive the emotional torture during depression? At night, she cannot keep her mind from racing. She stares out her tiny window. City lights twinkle in the dark. There are no stars, no mountains. She steps in line with the other women to go outside to the yard. She bends down to roll her pant legs. She is so accustomed to their voices, her mind does not even attempt to decipher the monotone buzzing that fills the air around her, wishing only to block it out. She looks up, glances into the large square window that allows one to see into the special management and disciplinary unit for men, men's head cases and mentally ill, housed with the jail's administrative segregations, the whole. 23-hour lockdown. Strange that the two are housed together. The doped-up, sad faces look to her, to any woman with watery, bloodshot eyes, for just one smile, some recognition, some acknowledgement that they are still men despite their current state of being. Their eyes beg. Look beyond the madness of my hair, my unshaven face, my soiled clothes, and maybe, just maybe. She moves swiftly, determined, precise steps directed, a solid mass, feminine, fluid. They look at her. They cannot see her. They look at her hair, seeing only a man's. Short, cropped, thick, black, not knowing they would not understand her roots. They look at her eyes, thinking how they'd like those eyes to look at them. Perfect spheres, night's Milky Ways. Not knowing they would not withstand her gaze. They look at her mouth and want her to speak to them. Satin streaming, moving, not knowing they would not understand her words. They look at her body, wanting it next to theirs. Graceful, strong, built, maintained. Not knowing they would not know how to embrace it. They look at her heart, wanting it to be theirs, beating, pumping, not knowing how they would wound it. They look at her, wanting her, kind, unguarded, willful, proud, not knowing she would destroy them in their simple ignorance. I look at her as my pen runs dry. Excited, scared, cautious, lovingly, not knowing what she'll do to me. Because I do not look at her. I see her. They look at her hands. Do they look at her hands? Soft, small, not knowing they cannot see her. All I, walking out of the building, don't forget the laundry. I, under the sky, blanketed walkway, puddle. Don't forget the laundry. I, feeling the drops. Don't forget the laundry. I, standing at my feet, moving without direction. Don't forget the laundry. I, seeing the worms scattered along the path, enjoying cool, wet concrete. I'll save them, each and every one. I'll save them. I, standing in line, waiting, thinking, I'll save them, each and every one. I, taking my medications, I'll save them, each and every one. I, walking back upon the prison path. Sun Yang, don't forget. Nothing sadder than the shriveled bodies of the worms that couldn't make it back before the sun. So I found that to be a very illuminating piece about these issues of despair. I don't approach the subject of incarceration religiously or via religion. I have all kinds of respect for people who do. The first person I was engaged to in my life went to work with Mother Teresa twice. Then came back here. I'm so proud of her. I still love her to this day. Came back here, and she started the prison outreach for the state of Kansas. I understand that, how valuable that is to some, but I also know it misses the hearts and the understandings of so many who just can't go for that idea, but whose lives are just as valuable as those who do subscribe to it. So Malia Sun Yang was so brilliant that how she survived ultimately was she would go into the prison library, or the law library, and she would read and read and read and read and read. And she became, inside the prison, she became, in quotes, a prison lawyer, where she would advise particularly these Native American women of their rights, who really didn't understand that they had rights. They're Native Americans. How could they possibly have rights? But they did have rights. And so she became known as the counsel that they would go to find out what their options might be, find out from another prisoner how they might survive. She was offered parole after 2 years of being there, and she stayed there. She says, no, I want to finish out. I want to finish out for two reasons, because I counsel these women here and because, to be honest with you, I am not certain that I am still, that I would be able to go outside of the prison and to function as I should function in order to prevent myself from returning. So basically, Chuck, that's about all I have for you today.
Well, okay. Well, that was excellent, Michael. And in a way, it's good that you is all you have, because now this should give us time to let Anthony read the prison writing that he was mentioning at the end of the last segment. So, Anthony,
yeah, I think that's an excellent idea. I kind of cut it a little bit short because I thought about that during the last segment when I heard that he wanted to read something and he said it would only take about 5 minutes. And so, Anthony,
okay.
Go for it.
Very cool. Okay. You guys ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. This is part of a zine called Conflicts of Interest by Timothy Trujillo. But this piece is by a man called Cacalatl Michihuali. He's in Corcoran, and he was part of the organizers of the prison strike waves. Okay, so he starts out, or I'll start a few paragraphs in. The police abuse I grew up around was commonplace and not restricted to abuses on drug dealers and gangbangers. As a gang member, I naturally experienced my share of it, but I saw police harass and assault everyone else, from street vendors
to my 5-year-old brother, whom a pig snatched by the throat for throwing rocks at the neighbor's kids. Society seemed oblivious to it all until the beating of a black man named Rodney King. He grew up in L.A. by 4 white Los Angeles cops was caught on videotape. Not surprisingly, many people came to the defense of the police and blamed the victim. On the left, a small handful of liberals did a lot of fist-shaking and angrily condemned the beating. Nevertheless, the abuses continued, and though the 4 pigs got indicted, an all-white jury found them not guilty. People in South Central Los Angeles erupted in anger, setting the city ablaze with unorganized week-long attacks on businesses throughout the city. A curfew was imposed, and the National Guard was sent in. While the ashes still smoldered, the Bloods and Crips called a truce. The following year, the Mexican gangs did the same. Neither truce lasted very long, and the police continually attempted to undermine both. We don't need their help. We were soon killing each other again, and the cops were gladly throwing us in jail for it. Like many others around me, I was in and out of juvenile institutions and eventually graduated to the adult system. The courts were so biased against people of color and the poor that only the willfully ignorant could expect to be treated fairly. For the poor, posting bail was practically impossible due to the imposition of ridiculously high extortion fees in exchange for freedom. In effect, the burden of proof is placed on the accused, who languishes in a filthy county jail, guilty until proven innocent. Unless we can afford a lawyer, which almost none of us can, we're stuck with public defenders who help railroad us with our half-ass efforts during trial or their attempts to have us cut deals that entail exceedingly long amounts of time. The defendant's lack of resources practically ensures an effortless prosecution and a lengthy prison term. After all, judges don't think twice about handing out the harshest sentence possible to a penniless thug. In prison, many of us pick up a book for the very first time, mostly out of sheer boredom. I used to read nothing but fictional crap until someone handed me a history book. It was an enlightening, thought-provoking account of history, not the whitewashed, self-congratulatory, overbearing bullshit I was tortured with in school. Until then, I wasn't even aware that such literature existed. It was as if a whole new world had opened up for me. Even more surprising was how incredibly easy it was to get this kind of literature. Other cons, books for prisoner programs, distros, etc. I kept reading books that allowed my thinking to expand beyond the parameters set by capitalist culture. I realized that I had been living in a prison my whole life, and liberation could only come by first breaking the colonialist chains that enslaved my own mind. My past and present made me naturally receptive to anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, and anti-racist views. I knew what marginalization, class warfare, and racism were before I knew the words to describe them. For me, there was nothing subtle about it. I've realized that prisoners don't need to learn the truth so much as we need to learn not to ignore it. It's not hard to recognize the familiar pattern of hypocrisy and coercion in all levels of government. The attitudes taken towards our communities and local police forces are all too similar to the attitudes taken towards foreign nations and the U.S.'s global police force, i.e. the military. The police beat us down or kill us on our blocks, and the rest of society hails them for their bravery and heroism. U.S. airstrikes blow women and children to pieces, and the response is the same. There exists a repugnant lack of concern for the victims of the powerful in this society. People just plain refuse to believe that the military is anything less than the most noble group of men and women who bomb, invade, and occupy foreign nations in order to protect us, spread democracy, and somehow, from all the way across the globe, ensure that we have a Bill of Rights here in the U.S. Constant repetition somehow stands as a substitute for evidence or logic and making these assertions believable. Atrocities may be committed in the process, but we have to remember the morally inferior, democratically challenged people our troops have to deal with. We have to ask, what the hell are prisons good for when the biggest criminals can commit torture, carry out mass killings, rob, and extort entire nations with impunity, never having to worry about setting foot in one of these cells. Realization that the authorities do keep us in here are free to commit much more and much worse crimes than all of us put together is naturally accompanied by anger. But what should we do with that anger? I certainly can't fault anyone who lashes out violently against their oppressor, but I do prefer that all our actions are goal-oriented. I know that above all else, tyrants fear the political organization of the oppressed around their own interests. They'd rather see us sitting in front of a television screen eroding our ability to think on our own than reading thought-provoking literature and questioning the legitimacy of their most cherished conventions. They'd rather see fragmentation than solidarity. They'd rather see so-called OGs in prison more concerned in portraying a hardcore image of themselves than helping politicize our youth. They'd rather see us all living in our own delusionary little worlds than forming study groups. They know that if we learn how to learn together, we will quickly learn to identify our collective interests. I do not pretend to tell anyone how they should channel their anger. My own thinking about social revolution is still nascent. I haven't delved deep into the writings of Marx, Lenin, Trotsky, Mao, Bakunin, and Kropotkin. Experience, however, has made me keenly aware of the nature of our common enemy and allowed me to reach critical conclusions. I'm convinced of the need for revolution and the forcible replacement of capitalism. I've realized that these greedy, insatiable bastards who run the world must be stopped and the system that makes it possible for them to do so abolished. Coming to grips with reality is not an easy thing to do for many of us in prison. After all, consciousness compels us to act or admit our cowardice, and one can easily feel overwhelmed by the power of the state. We have no guns. The pigs hold tremendous power over us. They control almost every aspect of our lives. Many would rather sit passively in front of the precious TVs than conversate about what they're watching on TV for the rest of their lives. Like content slaves who can't imagine life without their master, they refuse to consider escaping the plantation. Our own cowardice is something we refuse to face, so we disguise it with apathy or defeatism. We're all going to die anyway, many within these walls. We could either live like caged lions or caged mice. A well-known quote attributed to the Mexican revolutionary Emilio Zapata comes to mind. I'd rather die fighting on my feet than live on my knees.
Anthony, we've got to cut it short there.
All right.
We're out of
That's
time.
That's the end of it.
Okay, perfect. Well, great.
Anthony, what is the name of that author?
His name is... Where is that? His name is C-A-C-A-L-O-T-L-M-A-C-E-H-U-A-L-L-I. I don't know exactly how to say it.
You might want to repeat that after the station break, and we have to
okay.
stop now. All right.
Make it all right.
Talk to everybody soon.
All right.
Well, hello, everyone. We are back. The New American Dream Radio Show. This is our final segment of the evening. That was a really good one. It's really good show so far, the whole show. I thank all of my guests. We're going to start off this segment. Azura, this is mostly going to be your segment, so I would like you to introduce the recording. Azura?
Are you about to play the music?
I'm about to play the music, so I would like you to introduce it for me.
Sure. So I ended up marrying one of my pen pals. His name is Blackjack the Arsonist. We actually met through Anthony Rayson in a very roundabout way. When he was awaiting his appeal, he wrote to South Chicago ABC Zine and Distro, who sent him some of Sean Swain's work. And then he was in the library at Mansfield and saw Swain's name and said, "Hey, are you the guy who ran for governor of Ohio from prison on a platform of abolishing the government in 90 days. And Sean said, yep, that's me. So anyway, so thank you for introducing me to my husband, or at least introducing him to Sean so that Sean can introduce me to him. So anyway, Blackjack, as he goes musically, is a very talented musician. And let's go ahead and just listen to him.
Okay. This is called Free Inmate Letter.
To whom it may concern. What up? Remember me? Or has too much haze just burned enough of your brain cells that you can't tell yet who conveyed these words by looking at the name on the envelope, so for clues you aim to search? I'm just playing. How have you been? Ain't too sure when's the last time the two of us mates conversed. You must ain't have heard. I've been incarcerated. Yards and cages. Ooh, the state's absurd, but I'll get to that later, yo. I'm saying, though, you must ain't have heard. Come on, now. Who ain't say the word? Dude, you ain't observed that I've been MIA for over a decade? Ooh, that straight up hurts. You knew the day they served me time. Mom Duke's related personally to you. You don't think I'm worth it to just feign concern? What's that about? Us two were aces, were two Hellraisers merged. Now, it's to the pavement's curb you kick me? Shoot, that's hateful, Herb. But I choose to stay unspurned. Instead, I excuse the hate, because mercy has been given to me. Forgiveness is key to true salvation's work. Believe it or not, it's true. I'm saved, rebirthed, to a faithful servant of the Lord Yeshua, Jesus Christ, the truth, the way, the word, the life, the only begotten Son of the Father who created earth and all the heavens in less than 7 days. My views have changed, for sure. But I digress. Yes, you've displayed some hurtful hues parading your true colors pertaining to the way you view estrangement, sir. If it was you in chains and yours truly did you this way, burn. But I guess since I put myself here, then my dues to pay, not yours. Yeah, well, you can say that, sure. The truth's a raking term more skilled than you. It states that your whole conclusion's based on pure falsehood most humans may assert to be true, since they have learned only with views the state encourages. Funny. My indictment bill is proof the state observes multitudes of layman workers as consumers raised to purchase goods. If you obey their terms, a diminutive wage you'll earn. But step outside that line one time, state blues and chains emerge. Look up prison industrial complex on Google. Make the search. It's big business to this nation's bursars, dude. The famed one person, the Occupy movement, made a permanent fixture to the mainstream vernacular as fluent slave owners running this new plantation turf. See, the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution states a person cannot be legally used or made to work as a human slave or serve unless convicted of a felony. No confusion. Gauge the words. If you're in prison, you're a slave. Now, compute the wage figures. A shrewd entrepreneur employer, to inflate his worth, wouldn't choose to pay for workers when he could use free laborers. Now, would he? No. It's human nature's worst attribute. Voracious thirst for more despite who else may suffer. Now the U.S. claims the first place spot for who enslaves most per capita. Use your brains to work out why. Spooker, gains, returns. So just remember, at any moment it could happen to you. Detainment hurts, but it's worse. If you think the U.S. Constitution states a person cannot be legally used or made to work as a human slave or serve unless convicted of a felony. No confusion. Gauge the words. If you're in prison, you're a slave. Now, compute the wage figures. A shrewd entrepreneur employer, to inflate his worth, wouldn't choose to pay for workers when he could use free laborers. Now, would he? No. It's human nature's worst attribute. Voracious thirst for more despite who else may suffer. And now the U.S. claims the first place spot for who enslaves most per capita. Use your brains to work out why. Spooker, gains, returns. So just remember, at any moment it could happen to you. Entertainment hurts, but it's worse. Do you think you can handle living this life of abuse and rage and hurt, where COs use their mace that burns or clubs that bruise to make you learn that they're in charge and you inmates are worse? When feuds with gangs occur, ain't no fists. They're using shanks to murder you. Dudes with blades under their tongues to buck 50. A chump swiftly will soothe their prey with words, rock them to sleep with sweet talk, then the creeps will mutate. Rapist jerks. You're always on guard. No room for making mirth. That's super dangerous. Twerps, whom you think were pure, would steal from you so they can splurge. Solitude's a made-up word. It's only you to make you yearn for peace and quiet that you never find. This gloom and hatred. Grr, I'm really happy that you're not in prison, my dude. This place is cursed. Man, I'm gone. You ain't got to write back. Yours truly, James, the word. P.S., by the way, the Bible states in Genesis 2, the 18th verse, that a man ain't supposed to be alone. So when you forsake a person, you should know God doesn't like it much. We cool, the same, you heard? You guys told me you trust that I'm praying for you Sunday at church.
Yeah, wow. It's called Every Day.
That was so quite something.
I wanted, yeah, he's great. I wanted to start my segment by reading a short clip by Connor Stevens. I have thought a lot about the motto, Fire to the Prisons. In the direct sense, I embrace the fiery rage and implicit abolitionism that the phrase embodies. I think that immensely powerful sense of dignified rage is critical to remaining bounded and potent. However, I have also come to consider deeper significances. There is the fire of knowledge. We must flood the prisons with knowledge. But there is, most importantly of all, the fire of love. We must flood the prisons with love. The fire of love. A love for humanity. We must never reduce people to mere statistics or ideological categories or the erasure involved in dogma. That was Connor Stevens of the Cleveland Four. I have a few things that I'd like to talk about, not enough time for any of them. The need for bringing love into prisons. I spent a week earlier this month visiting prisoners in Ohio. One prison I was unable to get into, I went to visit Greg Curry, who has been on trumped up charges for drugs that he never had, that were never on him. They claimed that he was mailed drugs. And on the basis of that, they increased his security levels. So this last time that I went to see him, he was behind glass, and they took the first 45 minutes of visitation due to some sort of computer glitch, they claimed. And, you know, I went to visit Sadiq Hassan at Ohio State Penitentiary, which was the only visit where I was treated with dignity and respect. I was running late, and I called to make sure that my visit wouldn't get canceled. You have to have reservations in Ohio. And the visitation officer actually notified him that I was running late, which I would have never even considered to ask for such dignity. And then in terms of visiting Blackjack, you know, this was our first visit as a married couple. And man, if you want to know that prisons don't like love, just try to be affectionate to somebody in a visiting room. We got hounded for 4 days. I was basically told that I couldn't touch his head at all because clearly it's a security problem if I'm playing with his hair. My mom was trying to make me feel better, and she said, well, you know, your kisses are explosive. That's the reason why they keep coming after you like this. But I think that it's just important to be connected with people and sending in love. I do have an update about what's going on with the serious misconduct panel. The long and the short of it is that they're trying to make it much easier for prisoners to be sent to administrative segregation, solitary confinement for 180 days, and then to have their security level increased. They now no longer need a member external to the unit to make that happen. And the third thing on my mind was to talk about making prisons more expensive. In Texas, most of our prisons don't have air conditioning, and the inside temperatures get to be about 120 degrees. And any time that people have tried to lobby for air conditioning, Texas Department of Criminal Justice just says, well, it's too expensive. Take about $3 billion to air condition everything. And a friend recently said, you know, they tell people if you don't want to do the time, don't commit the crime. How about saying that if you don't want to spend the money to incarcerate people, then just don't lock them up?
Definitely.
I did want to leave time if there were any questions.
Okay. Well,
I'm happy to continue.
Let's see. Who Okay. Who's still here?
Anthony,
are you
here?
Okay.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Patera, I'm still here, Chuck. Patera,
okay,
I'm
good.
Still here. I just want to comment that I'm very, very moved by what you just said about bringing love inside.
Yes.
That there are several levels of consideration for abolition, to reform the criminal justice system. To in New York, we had just won a big victory on cash bail. It's been abolished in New York. But the love piece that you mentioned, the humanity, to me, that's the most critical part. That whoever we are, wherever we are, whoever we are, that seeing that love that you talked about, bring that light in the darkness, bring that hope to me. I just want to respond to that. Thank you very much for that. I was very touched by that, remembering my days at Sing Sing.
Well, thank you. You know, I think I'm personally a pacifist, and one of the things that we like to say is that love is a force more powerful. And I think that people have this idea that love is a mere wishing well. And that's not true, right? Love is a fighting force. Love is a living principle. And I think that sometimes we have this idea that love as a force, you know, either belongs to the religious or that it belongs to this or it belongs to that. But it's a universal human force that connects us all. And I think that the fundamental problem with prisons is the idea that once you have done something wrong, that you are now to be eliminated from society, right? That you are no longer worthy of connection, of belonging into the community, or of love. And this is problematic on a statistical level. The overwhelming majority of prisoners will return to the community, worse for wear. But on a philosophical level, right, because my day job is that I teach philosophy, it's fundamentally forgetting that every single person is capable of change and that every person is worthy of dignity and of love and has a need for education. You know, so I think it's important for us not to think of love as a passive force, but to be thinking of it
as
something that we could operationalize, right?
Yes,
as
yes.
an active force that we can
yes,
bring into
yes,
the prisons.
Yes.
And, you know, just getting back to Anthony and his amazing work, right, having sent all of these zines, I can't even imagine how many, over the last two decades, that's love, right? It's the love of education. It's the love of connection. It's giving prisoners a voice. It's the recognition that people on the outside can read your stuff and recognize you. It's that other prisoners may know your words and be warmed by them. And that, you know, there's a revolutionary zeal that needs to be moved. So, you know, that's just, I think that for those who have been listening the whole 2 hours, there's been a lot of people thanking Anthony. And I think for that, you know, and as well for you, bringing love into the unit. You know, I think it definitely makes a difference to have chaplains that show love and show compassion and show kindness versus ones that just kind of look down their nose at people and act like, well, you know, you know what you did and why you're here, as if any of us are any better, right? I mean, I like to say I've committed tons of felonies. I just didn't happen to get caught.
That's absolutely right. I was thinking as you were speaking that today, today the 30th of January, is the anniversary of Mahatma Gandhi. And one of the things he said was, when you're in a struggle like this, first they ignore you, they laugh at you, they fight you, and then you win. That we can't give up that struggle, that, you know, that dismissive, you know, they're criminals, they're convicts. I used to say to the guys, what do you call yourselves? You know, you're somebody's brother, you're somebody's son, you're somebody's cousin, you're somebody's uncle. You know, remember that. Don't just accept the number they were given by the department. So that was almost a ritual to say, you know, you're somebody, you're a human being. So, and thinking, you know, when I met Chuck, I met him at Martin Luther King celebration in Fort Lauderdale. That was the first time I met him. And of course, King talked about love all the time the power of love, right, the most powerful force we have. So thank you for that again. On,
you know,
on
you
reminding
reminded
us
me of
that
a story. You reminded
Everyone
me of a story
deserves
during the 20s.
Azura, go ahead.
Everyone deserves. Go ahead.
What he said reminded me of a story during the 2016 strike. You know, people that are syndicalizing prisoners will refer to them as incarcerated workers versus prisoners or inmates or felons or whatever. And every once in a while, being part of prison abolition, prisoner support, we get a little bit of flack from people who say you shouldn't be calling them prisoners. And I got this phone call from this guy who was reporting that Red Onion prison had had 17 guys on hunger strike for 3 weeks, right? High security facility in Virginia. And when he identified himself, he gave me his IWW number and identified himself in terms of his labor sector, right? And it was this beautiful moment of speaking to a union brother as a union sister, right? And that instead of him having to give me his inmate number, he could give me his union number, and that that was a way for him to identify himself. So I think that it's really important for us to humanize prisoners really by any wording necessary and possible, you know, whether it's talking about people in terms of their relation to you, right? My brother, my sister, my spouse, you know, to talk to people in terms of brother and sister, but just to really be talking about people as people, because they are. They're just people who happen to be on the other side of the razor wire, and that makes it easier to love. Anthony, you were saying?
Yeah, when you talk about loving people, prisoners, it comes back to you 10 times more. You learn way more than you impart to them, really. I mean, my life has really been broadened by the comradeship and just sheer brotherhood and sisterhood and love that I've gotten from all kinds of prisoners. And when I'm having a bad time, when a family member is dying or something, they're the first ones to come to comfort me, you know? So, in fact, I'm closer to prisoners, some prisoners, than my own brothers. So, you know, it goes beyond just support. That's ridiculous. They're supporting us. They're teaching us. And,
yeah,
you know, everyone
absolutely
deserves to to know that there's someone in this world that gives a damn about them, genuinely, you know?
Yes.
And a lot
yeah
of that with prisoners, I think, is with handwritten letters. You have to write a lot of letters to them. You got to relate to them individually, you know, get in that, so their head, get becoming their friends. How are you going to befriend them if you don't, you know, share your personality and, you know, tell them how you feel and what you want to do together and, you know, work together and be together. And then when they come out, meet them and try to help them settle somewhere,
right,
or, you know, answer their phone calls or whatever.
That's right. Some of the professors from the Bad Prison Initiative from Bad College in Millbrook, they will tell you when you ask them that the men at Sing Sing were some of the best students they ever had.
Yeah.
In terms of
some brilliant people.
You know, uh-huh. Absolutely. So you are absolutely right. I mean, Professor.
So I'm thrilled with my collaborators. They're brilliant. They're talented. They're courageous. You know, I would have never learned any of this stuff if it wasn't for them. I mean, they're the ones that are getting put on the chop block. They're the ones getting gassed and beaten and dragged around and, you know, having their sentence extended. So I'm just doing what any person should do, I think. I mean, it feels kind of normal what I do, you know? But
and for any listeners that are interested in writing letters to prisoners, this is just a quick reminder. You can get a hold of us at iheartcaps.org. And we'll be happy to talk you through the process. I really appreciated what Anthony said about how rewarding it is. I think people get into it thinking that it's charity. And, you know, at least as an anarchist, I come out of it understanding that, no, it really is about mutual aid. I just really want to second what Anthony is saying in terms of, you know, that obviously every individual is different. I think we have this idea that prisoner just is monolith block, and that's not true either. Mm. But in general, I have had some of the most uplifting, compassionate conversations, you know, with people being concerned about me and being there for me and giving me really good advice, you know, on concrete things like how to fix my car to, you know, being able to be there for me emotionally. And I think it's important for people to remember the value that somebody has doesn't decrease when they walk in through the razor wire. I mean, certainly correctional officers do their best to make you as a visitor and them as the person who's incarcerated feel like less of a person. But I think that that's where the love piece and the education piece comes in, to really be able to have that innate sense of dignity and worth and push back and just say, no, that's not what this is. And, you know, this is why chaplains who do their job are so important, because they're bringing that light in. They're bringing that love in, especially for people who aren't getting it, you know, through other places. And some of the people that I write, I mean, they literally don't have anyone else to write them, or in certain cases to visit them. And, you know, it's really wonderful knowing that you can just take a couple of minutes and send somebody a postcard or, you know, photocopy a zine and get it on the way, and that you can make a really huge concrete difference in somebody's life today just by picking up a postcard and writing to them.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that at graduation, after the guys have finished their coursework, at least one or two don't have anybody, no family member, nobody. So sometimes I give my own kids or my wife to come and be their family. Because they have a table, you know, every graduate has a table. And so if you have no family coming, then you're going to sit on the table yourself with your name. So I would give my kids have come, my children and my boys have come, my wife has come. So you get them to come, you get them approved so they can come and sit and be their family. So if you don't have a family, you know, I say, look, this is your family. So we'll take a picture, graduation, you know, when you put a cap and gown and you're marching down and pump and, you know, whatever that song is they play for graduates, you know, and you sit at the table.
Pomp and circumstance.
Yeah, right.
But that's it. Pomp and circumstance. But you can be, you know, my wife, my kids can be their family. So, and they know them, you know, when they come out, they write to them. So it is possible. It is.
We're about out of time, and I just want to thank the three of you for sticking with me for the whole show. And also the excellent columns that we had, or interviews that we had from Frank Cordero and Michael Annis. I really appreciate all of you, Patero Sabuni, Anthony Rayson, Azura Crispino, and I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's listener-supported radio, so they do deserve your support. Head on over to freedomslips.com and find that button. And listeners, you're the ones I appreciate the most, because you're the ones that make everything work, and you know, so we're not just talking to ourselves. We're talking to you. Thank you, everyone, and good night.
Good night.
Good night, Jared. Thank
you for having me.
Thank you so much. I'm wonderful to be with you.
It really has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.